Was he helping someone who could, in fact, spell doom for humanity? Kemp shook his head. You had to work with what you knew. 63. Purchase. I'd like to buy your ship. Kemp waited. The silence at the other end of the line was pretty much what he'd expected. Finally, Captain Jennings said,
Okay. This seems like a significant turnaround from our previous conversation. May I ask why?
Kemp didn't want to lie to the captain. He trusted and respected the man far too much. Sir, I would rather not answer that question, although I will if you push me. I will say, though, that not doing so would place a layer of deniability between you and, recent events. And we did discuss me purchasing your ship several weeks ago. We would both be able to truthfully state that, under oath.
Under oath? Charlie, I am severely tempted to push the issue and demand an explanation. But I trust your judgment. Let me ask this. Is there a point somewhere in the future where you'll be able to explain all this?
Yes, sir. Pretty sure. It's just a little, fluid right now.
Okay, then.
Jennings named a price, and Kemp's eyebrows rose almost to his hairline. Captain, you could get more than that at a scrapyard.
Placing you in my debt, Doctor. That price, plus an eventual explanation.
Done. I'll have the money wired to you immediately. Yes, in advance of the paperwork. I want the audit trail to start right away.
Fair enough. Anything else, Doctor?
Have you taken possession of your new ship?
Yes, since you ask. I'm heading up to give her a shakedown cruise tomorrow.
Then I'd like to hire your ship. There were several seconds of silence before the captain answered.
Ship. Why do you need mine?
To find mine.
This had better be one doozy of a story, Kemp.
Kemp received a call from Dr. Narang less than an hour after hanging up with the captain.
I understand you're going on a little trip,
she said without preamble. The doctor stared at the phone for a moment, nonplussed, then putting it back to his ear, he said, Are you spying on me?
Everyone who had anything to do with the Pritchard incident is flagged for travel, and will be for a year. You've booked a flight to Olympus Station, and the computer kicked it up to me.
Huh. Welcome to 1994.
1984? Jeez, amateurs.
Okay. So is this an official call of some kind, Dr. Narang?
No, Charlie, it isn't. I was just curious. Anything new on the whole Pritchard thing?
Well, he's still alive, does that count? Kemp thought. He was unsure how much he should tell her. He thought he could trust Maddie, but his recent experiences had left him feeling both paranoid and justified in the feeling. I'm going on a cruise with Captain Jennings, he finally said. The captain is taking possession of his new ship and has invited me along. Do you have a few spare days? I'll spring for the shuttle. There was silence on the line as Narang apparently considered his invitation. Then,
You know, that sounds like a great idea. I'll meet you at Olympus Station.
One day later, Kemp was on Olympus Station. He stood up as Dr. Narang walked up to his table, a cup in her hand and the distinctive aroma of tea preceding her. Without preamble, Narang said to him,
I've been second-guessing myself all night. It sounded like you were trying to send a message on the phone, but when I go over your actual words in my head, they sound completely innocent. Am I on a wild goose chase?
Kemp grinned at her. No, as it turns out, I was trying to be mysterious, all the while wondering if I was being over-the-top paranoid. The whole cloak-and-dagger thing has me out of my depth.
I understand you are now the proud owner of a slightly used mining ship.
She gave him a sideways look.
Heading up to claim it?
Yep. I am the owner of the Mad Astra, and I guess I am hoping to claim it, but first I have to find it. Narang's eyes went round.
It's not at the Navy base?
No. Apparently Ivan is now a space pirate. Narang stared at Kemp silently for several seconds, her jaw in danger of unhinging.
Explain, please.
As Ivan put it, reports of his death are greatly exaggerated. He escaped the module, stole the Astra, and made off for parts unknown.
That poor man. All of this just because he reached for an artifact.
They both nodded, sharing a moment of commiseration for the absent space pirate. Narang stared searchingly at Kemp's face.
By the way, if he's taken off for parts unknown, where exactly are you going to go looking for him?
It's a long shot. Narang made an on with it motion with her hand. Ivan mentioned a recurring image of a bear cub early on when he first finished his transformation. He reminded me of it later without specifically mentioning details.
Red flag, that?
Yep. Meant it was important, and he didn't want any listeners at his end to know. The image was of a bear cub, like I said.
A bear cub?
Narang looked perplexed. A minor Ursa? Narang started to laugh.
Ursa Minor. The Little Dipper. It was referring to the constellation?
Yes. I think that's where the computer wants him to direct his communications.
Wait, what? Communications? Charlie, you need to back up a few steps.
Kemp gave Narang an apologetic smile. Yeah, Ivan is sharing his head with a computer of alien origin which wants to communicate with its makers somehow.
But which star?
Kemp shrugged. I don't think it matters. Or maybe he'll know more when he's able to transmit, but in any case, most of them are more than 100 light years away. This won't be a quick conversation. She thought for a moment.
I guess he can just beam a message to each star in that general direction, then start listening at the appropriate round-trip time.
Yes. Ivan mentioned at one point that the makers are very patient. If they're like Ivan, well, I doubt lifespan is an issue. How long did the nanites live? Waiting in the artifact for someone to come along. What does patient mean when you're immortal anyway? Money might be the root of all evil. Oh, wait, no. It was the love of money. Kemp shook his head, trying to get his thoughts organized. Big mistake in free fall, even for a veteran of space travel. He gritted his teeth, waiting for the nausea to subside. But anyway. Based on the offer of a suitable gratuity, the ferry pilot had founded within himself to allow Kemp and Narang to sit in the cramped bridge for the short trip to the Getting Ahead. Jennings's new ship loomed large in the forward viewport as they approached.
It's a beaut, Narang breathed.
Sure is, the pilot enthused. Looks modified as well. The standard BG-4502 has smaller nacelles. I'm pretty sure this one's been souped up, maybe with 4600 series parts. The owner seems to know what he's doing. Kemp grinned.
I would have to agree.
The ferry sidled up and connected to the vessel's airlock. After completing the transaction with the pilot, Kemp and Narang exited the ferry. Captain Jennings was waiting on the other side of the boarding connection. He beamed at them, obviously proud to bursting of his new ship. The captain promised a full tour as soon as the ship was underway. Given the destination, though, the sooner they departed, the better. A surprise awaited them when they got on the bridge. Lita Generis swiveled around in the pilot's chair and gave everyone a sloppy salute. It meant nothing to Narang, of course, but Kemp grinned at Generis.
Did the captain shanghai you?
She returned the smile and shook her head.
News travels. I heard about Ivan. When I phoned Captain Jennings to talk about it, he informed me that things weren't completely cut and dry. So, I re-upped.
Jennings gave his normal, close-lipped smile, barely visible under his mustache.
Of course, it's not a tour as such, but we will be spaceside for a while, and possibly out-system.
What?
Narang looked concerned.
Outside of the Earth-Moon system, Kemp said in an aside. Not outside the solar system. The ship isn't that good.
You might be surprised, Doctor, the captain said cryptically. For the moment, if everyone would grab a seat.
They took seats in the bridge, after promising not to touch any controls. Kemp looked around at the impressive array of stations, consoles, panels, and monitors.
You can run this with just the two of you?
Jennings nodded.
I could run the getting ahead by myself. I would never think to do so on an actual mining tour, of course, but the AI and the new BG series vessels can, in principle, fly the ship with no human oversight, even follow a specified flight plan with scheduled stops.
The captain tapped his forehead.
Speaking of which, I'm going to give all of you voice authority for the duration of the voyage. Single points of failure and all that. I think you're right, Dr. Kemp, that paranoia is rubbing off on all of us.
Narang laughed.
It's not paranoia if they're really out to get you.
One of the big advantages of the new series long-haul vessel, Captain Jennings said as they moved into the hab ring, is that you don't have to spin down the hab ring when you want to maneuver. They specify a maximum maneuvering torque, and it's pretty light, but unless you're dodging something, how fast do you really have to change direction?
Kemp nodded. The constant spinning up and spinning down of the hab ring had been an enormous pain on the Mad Astra. It tended to dictate carefully planned flight vectors in order to minimize time spent under thrust.
The ferry pilot mentioned something about you having done some mods. You're not going to rip the hab ring right off the ship the first time you pour it on, are you?
Jennings laughed.
No. The hab ring can actually withstand far more straight-line strain than even the 4600 nacelles can provide. Even on the Astra, we could technically have accelerated with the hab ring spinning. But if we did suddenly have to maneuver, we'd have popped the hab ring out of its bearings.
Jennings stopped and turned. With a flourish, he gestured to a row of doors.
And these are your staterooms.
Kemp looked in the first door and whistled. As an officer, he'd had a bigger room than the crew anyway, but this put his former room to shame.
I could get used to this.
Narang looked inside the next unit.
On the ICDC budget, I usually have to flag coach and share seat space with a barnyard animal.
Captain Jennings grinned.
Make yourselves at home, then come up to the bridge when you're ready.
Kemp watched as the captain walked down the corridor.
Now, there is a happy man.
64. Reports of my death. Moore pulled the next item from his in-basket. Unbelievable. It was over 250 years since the invention of computers, and for almost that long, pundits had been predicting a paperless society. Moore rubbed the sheet between thumb and forefinger. At least they were no longer using dead trees, but nowadays the use of plastics gave the environmentalists fits. You just couldn't win with the loony left. He scanned through the report. The Mad Astra had departed, headed for the Lunar Antipodal Docking Station. Moore snorted. They would charge Jennings 5 times what the Navy would have levied, and nickel and dime him for every little thing. Probably charge him for micrometeor impacts. Well, at least that was no longer his problem. Moore frowned for a moment. Strangely, the ICDC weren't coming on as strong as expected. And of course Jennings had had his teeth pulled, although Moore would have expected him to try something less direct. Internally, there was a push to have his use of a nuke investigated by the JAG, but other than that, Moore shrugged. All upside as far as he was concerned.
The Admiral continued to work through his in-basket. Promotions, disciplinary issues, logistics and supply, quarterly reviews, all the administrivia that he hated so much, but could do in his sleep. He glanced at the next item, a surveillance report, then scanned the contents quickly. His jaw dropped and he went back to the top and reread the whole thing slowly, several times.
Bentley!
There was a crash as Bentley's chair struck the wall, then he poked his head through the office door.
Sir?
The Mad Astra. Did anyone actually show up to pilot her?
Lieutenant Bentley looked confused for a moment, then went to his desk and began to dig through his files.
I have the departure report here, sir. All protocols handled properly, no citations. A completely forgettable event.
Find me the report on the arrival of the pilot.
Bentley spent several minutes at his workstation, then looked up to meet the Admiral's stare. A sheen of sweat showed on his forehead.
There doesn't seem to be any record of anyone arriving. Of course, they're different departments. There's no reason to tie the two together.
Moore leaned forward, his face in his hands. He took several deep breaths and tried for calm.
Contact Lunar Antipodal. Find out if the Astra ever showed up. For that matter, find out if they even expect it.
Bentley scrambled to comply, and Moore scanned down the report again. A transcript of a conversation between Dr. Charles Kemp and someone who purported to be Ivan Pritchard.
Shit and hell.
The officers seated around the table looked nervous, and well they should. Moore hadn't been forthcoming with details in his phone calls, but enough came through in his tone to make it clear that they were facing a major snafu, and attendance was not optional.
Pritchard is still alive.
Moore saw no reason to ease into it. Better to get the ball rolling as quickly as possible.
How? Said Castillo. You're not saying he survived the nuke?
Moore shook his head and nodded to Bentley. The lieutenant stepped forward and passed out a set of stapled sheets to each person. Moore waited until he left the room before continuing the discussion.
This is a surveillance report, a transcript of a conversation on Dr. Kemp's phone. It says it all, I think.
Admiral Richards frowned at him.
You had a tap on the doctor's phone? Was that authorized?
Oh, don't go all law and order on me, Richards. We all knew this would be a messy operation. The doctor had a history of tete-a-tetes with Pritchard. A tap on his phone was the obvious next step. We've put one on Robinson's phone as well.
Richards rubbed her forehead.
Damn, I wish I could un-know this. I think this puts us squarely over the line, Moore.
Whereas setting off a nuke in near-Earth space didn't. Really, Admiral?
Castillo interjected.
Let's deal with the immediate problem, please. The threat is still extant. Possibly worse now since Pritchard is in the wind.
Should we arrest Kemp?
Gerard asked.
For what exactly, Commodore?
Gerard frowned at Moore.
Conspiracy? Accessory after the fact? Conspiracy? To escape an illegal assassination attempt? Accessory to a successful escape from SAME? I don't see a prosecutor wanting to take on that particular challenge.
Moore rubbed his eyes with thumb and forefinger for a moment.
We could maybe work up something to do with theft of a spaceship, but we'd need Jennings to swear out a complaint. I don't imagine that working out for us either.
We are so much in the shit,
Gerard muttered. Moore chose to ignore him. If the man didn't get it together, though, steps would have to be taken. At that moment, Lieutenant Bentley came in waving some paper.
Response from Lunar Antipodal. No flight plan filed, no berth reserved, no contact, no arrival. They totally didn't know what we were talking about.
Moore lifted an eyebrow. It sounded like Bentley was going a little bit squirrely as well. He'd have to be watched.
Gentlemen, we have a situation. My immediate thought is to send out everything we have in a search pattern. Problems with that plan?
Authorization for starters, Castillo said. You've gone off the res, Admiral? Excuse me, he added, seeing Moore's return glare. We have gone off the res. The last thing we need is to attract a full board of inquiry, especially not right now. We might be forgiven later if we are ultimately successful. Right now, I just see a whole lot of heck in our future.
What about an exercise? We're due for one, Lieutenant Bentley said. Moore realized with a start that the lieutenant hadn't left the room after delivering the communication. That was a breach of protocol, as was his speaking out of turn. On the other hand, it was an excellent suggestion. Naval exercises were a tradition as old as the Navy itself, and often a smokescreen for other actions. And LaGrange 4 was overdue for one. Moore decided he would give Bentley the benefit of the doubt, this time around.
Good point, Lieutenant. What have we got available and how fast can we deploy? Consistent with this being a non-urgent, completely routine naval exercise, of course.
Sir? Bentley looked like he realized he'd overstepped, but couldn't get out of the mode.
We could make it an exercise based on an emergency rescue, where we don't know the precise location of the derelict ship.
Moore nodded.
Surprise exercise. Excellent.
And why was he being schooled by a lieutenant?
For the first time in his life, Moore wondered if he was getting too old for this.
Castillo looked skeptical.
Naval exercises are fine and dandy, Admiral, but you'll want to make sure you pull it off. The Navy has a history of accepting fait accompli if they're successful. Make sure you succeed.
Thanks, Alan. That clarifies things.
I'm not just spouting platitudes, Ted. I'm serious. An argument could be made for the nuke, at least, that it had theoretical support from the scenarios people. This will take you completely off the continent. I don't see any kind of defensive argument or rationalization that would work.
Moore sighed and nodded.
Understood. But so far we've deployed a nuclear device during peacetime and failed to accomplish the goal. If we throw in the towel at this point, we're not only criminals, we're also failures. I think our only valid option is to double down. Success is the only outcome that will bring us out of this with our asses intact.
65. Humanity's options. The Mad Astra floated in freefall, far enough from the Earth-Moon system to avoid visual detection, unless someone knew where to look. On the bridge, a silvery ball of nanites was slowly growing. Time for the next step, whatever that might be.
What now, Ralph?
We need a communications station.
The response was accompanied by the usual image of a little bear. Ivan pulled up a 3D map of the solar system in the holotank.
Where?
Unimportant.
Okay, then.
Best to head a little farther to Celestial North so they wouldn't be transmitting through the ecliptic. And if Dr. Kemp had picked up Ivan's hints, that's where he would head. Ivan wanted to be far enough from in-system clutter so that he'd be easily detectable on radar. Fortunately, Ralph, so far, seemed oblivious to that whole line of action. Ivan set the autopilot, then turned his attention back to Ralph.
Construction material?
Image of the Astra. They'd be using Ivan's ride as construction material.
That makes this a one-way trip, Ralph. What will happen next?
Makers will respond.
No. What will happen to us?
Unsure.
Image of warships. Image of riots. Emotion of contempt. Well, that was suboptimal.
What might happen, Ralph? What are the possible options?
Ivan received a series of images in quick succession. There were two groups, therefore two alternatives, presumably. They went by too fast to parse, but Ivan had recently found that he now had a perfect memory. He would have to take the time to work out a series of possible interpretations, then query Ralph. It was like a game of 20 questions where you didn't necessarily agree on the meanings of words. The main problem seemed to be Ralph itself. Whatever else it was not an AI. More like a very complex expert system. As near as Ivan could tell from their limited communications, Ralph didn't have an ego, a sense of self. It had directives, but no real sense of self-preservation or an agenda of its own. This appeared to be deliberate. Otherwise, Ralph would, as likely as not, switch sides to the arts. That Ralph seemed willing to admit this in such a matter-of-fact manner went a long way toward proving the statement. The problem with an expert system, even one as advanced as this, was that it had limited flexibility and no imagination. What it had instead were a series of goals and decision trees, which was where Ivan came in. He provided the local knowledge and the drive to accomplish the task. It seemed convoluted, but he was getting a sense of the age of the civilizations behind this scheme. They apparently had a lot of experience with this stuff. The goal seemed to be to welcome humanity into the, Federation. But first, they had to survive if the arts showed up. And, as it turned out, humanity also had to survive its own nature. From some of Ralph's comments, Ivan was beginning to get that this might be the more immediate threat. If the Makers were willing to help humanity out with some of these issues, then obviously Ivan should be cooperating fully. But there was still the possibility that Ralph's visit had more sinister consequences. Ralph was strangely reluctant to answer some questions, and Ivan's spidey sense was starting to twinge. He needed a strategy for the latter possibility. It would unfortunately probably involve deliberately getting himself blown up. He'd have to wing it to a large extent, but some chains of events did seem to be coming together in a way that could be useful. 66. Naval Exercise. 12 Navy vessels, 4 battle cruisers and 8 frigates set out from the LaGrange 4 Naval Base on a surprise exercise. Aboard the flagship, the cruiser outbound, Admiral Moore stood watching the bridge crew. A double horseshoe shape on 2 levels accommodated all the stations required on a Navy ship. Crew spoke quietly into their headsets and worked their panels with no wasted motion. The aura of calm efficiency made Moore nostalgic. Captain Chouanlé sat, relaxed but alert, in the command chair. Trim and clean-cut, his buzz-cut immaculate, the captain was a graduate of the new Naval Academy. Moore still wasn't completely convinced of the value of the changes, but so far Le seemed competent enough. A buzz of focused activity showed off the crew's skill. Moore felt the nostalgia turn to regret. He'd always wanted to make Admiral, and it had seemed like the pinnacle of his career at the time. But he admitted now that the days commanding a vessel had been the most enjoyable part of his time in the Navy. Le glanced in his direction, but would wait for the Admiral to volunteer information or give orders. In an exercise, unless Moore spoke up, he was invisible. Bentley had put together a masterful piece of detective work, collating and integrating observation and tracking data not only from the base, but several traffic control centers and shipyards in the Earth-Moon system. The resultant trajectory had considerable scope for error, but they at least had a general direction for the Mad Astra. Le raised an eyebrow at the specified coordinates, but followed orders without comment. Moore smiled. A rescue exercise at close to perpendicular to the ecliptic was unusual but not unheard of. The whole point of exercises, after all, was to practice activities that wouldn't be routine. After checking with Le, Moore retired to the captain's ready room. He settled into the chair behind the desk with a sigh. This wasn't a combat situation, so they were using the HAB bridge, which gave them normal half-G gravity.
At some point, Admiral Moore would have to upgrade the Sitcon, and they would move to the on-axis bridge. Moore hoped that time would be brief. Although he wouldn't admit it publicly, he'd always hated low-G and free-fall conditions. He pulled out his tablet and connected to NavNet. First, he checked with Bentley on his course analysis, but no joy. Bentley reported that his current estimate was probably about as good as it was going to get. Next, a quick email to Castillo, who had been tasked with repelling assaults from the ICDC and Jennings. While he waited for a response, he worked on tactical details for the current exercise. Castillo's response came back quickly, disturbingly so, until Moore read the contents.
No further attempted incursions. Both actors are quiet. No explanation forthcoming.
Moore smiled, glad for the unexpected reprieve. Then he lost his smile as the last sentence registered. Castillo considered this state of affairs anomalous, obviously, and so should he. Something else was in play. They had access to information of some kind that Moore did not. Moore reached into a drawer and pulled out a pen and notepad. Doodling always helped him think. Item. Jennings had been partially defanged with the Little Rock threat, but it would be naive to think that he'd just slink away. If Jennings thought Pritchard was dead, killed by the Navy, he'd be in high dudgeon. Therefore, Jennings believed Pritchard to be alive. Kemp had told him. Item. The ICDC had no real dog in this hunt. Without Narang pushing, the ICDC would coast to a stop. Therefore, Narang was no longer pushing. Kemp had told her. These events must have happened very recently, since he'd not yet seen transcripts of any such conversations. Therefore, they would be reacting now. This was beginning to resemble a conspiracy. Moore chuckled briefly at the irony of that thought coming from him. So, what could he expect? Jennings had purchased a new ship. He'd be itching to take it for a cruise in any case. Moore certainly would in his shoes. Moore reached for the intercom button and pressed it.
Lur here?
Captain, it is possible that a bogey either is or soon will be following our track. Please keep an eye open for it.
High command? Newsies? SSE? What?
Civilian and with good legs.
This is developing into a very odd exercise, Admiral. I hope this will all be clarified at some point.
So do I, Captain. So do I.
67. Strike Force. Ivan glanced at the monitor. Sure enough, he saw a dozen bright points of light leaving Earth's environs, heading his way. The corona from the fusion drives would be far more visible from the rear, of course, but there was enough omnidirectional glow to register, if you were looking for it. The Mad Astra was not, at the moment, maneuverable. Cannibalization of the ship to build the communications station involved periods of time where everything was in transition and nothing was operational. He'd have a working but much reduced version of the Astra in about 26 hours. Not soon enough to get out of range of the Navy. Even if he could run, doing so would leave the slowly growing communications station alone and defenseless. He ran some calculations. There didn't seem to be a solution that ended with both himself and the comms station able to survive the upcoming visit. The Astra had no armaments, defensive or otherwise, and Ralph didn't have any helpful suggestions. Ivan found that last bit especially interesting. The computer that ran his emulation was vastly powerful, with an effectively infinite storage capacity. But even granting that it didn't have all the knowledge of the makers, it didn't seem particularly resourceful. Maybe a sense of self-preservation was hard to inculcate in something that had no concept of self. The Navy had radar. They'd see anything coming in plenty of time to dodge or shoot back. They had better legs than the Astra, at least the old version. The stripped-down version, maybe not so much. However, they'd be sure to take the time to blow up the station, so he would be back to square one.
Nuts.
Was there an advantage to delaying Ralph's plan by letting the station be blown up? Not really. Communications with the Makers didn't seem to be a danger point in and of itself. Ralph was the real danger. If the attempt to send a message was foiled, who knew what Ralph might try next? Good strategy dictated that Ivan keep all the players in their most comfortable grooves, where they'd be the most predictable and controllable. Ivan sat back, an arm draped across a bare steel girder, and stared through the open wall frame into open space, pondering alternatives.
Danger.
From the Navy? Yeah, I'm working on it.
Are your people ever not fighting?
They believe we are a danger to them.
Their behavior is not rational.
Self-defense isn't rational?
In the absence of all pertinent facts? Yes.
That seemed a bit self-serving, but on the other hand, that would also require a sense of self. Ivan wondered if Ralph was perhaps growing one, but that was for another conversation.
Options?
I actually have an idea for handling the Navy. It'll set us back, but also give us more material to work with. We could end up with more resources for a bigger station, and a few accessories.
I am listening.
Not so fast. You've been refusing to answer certain questions, mostly to do with the human race's immediate future, so I'm offering a deal. I'll get us out of this if you'll be more forthcoming with me on this subject. The alternative is we just sit here and they blow us up.
I can deactivate you and take over.
And fail. Pretty sure your goal tree rates that outcome pretty low. I want to know what I'm working for, or I stop working. Things are in full play now, and I don't think you have enough knowledge of the situation to pull it off, even if your scenario templates cover any of this. So, deal or no deal?
Agreed.
All right, then. You first. I'm listening.
68. Counter-strike.
I don't understand, sir. This is supposed to be an exercise, a rescue exercise. Now we have an actual target, and you want us to treat it as hostile?
Admiral Moore pressed his lips together. Even with the difference in rank, he would have to play this carefully. He was already on shaky ground, both back home and here. If Captain Le decided to dig in his heels pending clarification, Moore would be helpless to do anything about it. And Lowe would be within his rights. Perhaps honesty, or at least some honesty, would work.
Captain, the exercise was a cover story. We are pursuing an enemy that could literally spell the end of the human race. The nuclear explosion outside LaGrange 4 was a failed attempt to take this enemy down. Now we have another opportunity, and no chance for him to sneak away.
A cover story. To fool whom?
The public, of course, and some government factions that would see this as counterproductive to their interests.
Like the chiefs of staff,
Lewis said. Too close. Far too close to home.
Like the ICDC.
Le drew back, a perplexed frown on his face. Good. A completely unexpected out-of-left-field answer had the advantage that it must be true, because why would someone lie in that manner? And in this case, there was just enough truth in the statement to give Moore's body language reinforcement. The captain pondered for a few moments, then nodded.
Provisionally, I will continue to follow orders. However, I reserve the right to seek clarification if this goes unshiny.
Understood, Captain. It would have to do. Radar? Any activity?
Nothing, sir. It's just sitting there.
Moore nodded in approval at Liz's regular checks. The captain might be ambivalent about his orders, but he was still a good officer and held the safety of his command paramount. Radar and long-range imaging showed what appeared to be a partly assembled radio telescope dish, with a few smaller objects floating nearby. It was a reasonable assumption that Pritchard's alien master wanted to phone home. So far, though, there'd been no detectable response from anything in the target area. Moore was suspicious. Pritchard had shown enough ingenuity in the previous debacle, but perhaps there really was nothing he could do. Or perhaps this was a decoy construction of some kind designed to distract them while Pritchard ran in another direction. Bah, pointless speculation. They would have to get there and check it out, and then destroy it. A quick discussion with Le confirmed Moore's estimate of their military capability. They had some hours before they would need to finalize plans. Moore decided that would be the time to thoroughly read Le in. Moore walked around the bridge, listening in on the low buzz of conversation between specialists, exchanges involving the strength of solar wind, level of magnetic flux, amount of radio traffic from civilian sources, unexpected density of interplanetary dust, gravity gradients, and so on. He was struck again by a wave of nostalgia. As a captain, he'd felt like he had the world on his shoulders. Now he saw it for the easy, focused job that it was. Following policy was so much easier than setting it. He glanced up at the captain and smiled, then returned to his customary position. Interplanetary dust. Dust? Shit! The outburst caused every head in the room to swivel to face him. Captain, get us out of here! Abort! Moore felt the panic on his face and didn't care.
Too late, Admiral.
That wasn't Captain Le's voice, or the voice of anyone in the room. It came from the intercom. Moore looked over at Le, who sat gripping his chair arms, frozen with confusion. Pritchard.
You bet, Admiral. Your ships have all been infected and are under my control, more or less. Of course, you don't know what's more and what's less, so maybe don't test me, okay? I'm still pissed at you for the nuke thing, by the way.
Moore gritted his teeth and said nothing. Captain Le stood and paced over to stop at each console and talk to his bridge crew. As he moved from station to station, his expression became steadily darker.
For what it's worth, Admiral, you've delayed me, at least. I had to toss all my spare nanites your way in order to have a hope of getting every ship. Now, I have to wait until I breed up a new batch before I can continue construction of my communications station.
And the ones that missed? What if they hit Earth?
They had specific orders, Admiral. Like the nanites in the module, they won't attempt to infect anyone else. You need to get over the idea that these are indiscriminate viral killing machines. There's no gray goo scenario here.
We have only your word for that.
Sure, but there's no reason for me to lie. If I meant to do that and wanted to, I'd just do it. Convincing you otherwise gains me nothing.
What do you want from us?
You mean other than not trying to blow me up all the time? I want you to go away. I want you to turn your ships around and head back. Except for two of them. I'll be keeping two of the cruisers. You can transfer personnel to the other ships.
And if we refuse?
Admiral, I'll be taking two ships. Your options are to retrieve your crew or leave them with me.
We could just blow them up.
Even if you could, which is not guaranteed, you'd just be wasting a lot of lives. I want the metal, not a working warship. Scrap works just fine for me.
Lur cut in.
May we have a few minutes to discuss this?
Of course, Captain.
Lur looked at his first officer.
I want a complete report. Status of all systems, all ships. Strategies, ideas, anything.
Commander Hansen nodded, then turned to begin her tasks. Captain Le stood.
Admiral Moore, if I could speak to you in my ready room.
Captain Le stared at Admiral Moore across the desk. Moore couldn't help contrasting the karmic space with the difference in ranks. He felt like a junior lieutenant about to get dressed down. Finally, Le spoke.
According to a quick inventory, we have zero control over our vessel. Every important system has been compromised. The other ships report identical problems. We are dead in the water. Commander Hansen may find something, of course, but right now I'm planning for the worst case.
Lur looked to the side for a moment.
Although it sticks in my craw to surrender a vessel without a fight, let alone two. I see no viable alternative. Sacrificing the lives of crew accomplishes nothing, since it's apparent this Pritchard character will get what he wants regardless.
He was silent for a moment, then sighed.
Admiral, I don't see any way to save this situation. We will lose two ships, cruisers no less, on what was supposed to be an exercise. You're going to be wearing this one.
Moore gave him a rueful smile.
Captain, I am so far down the rabbit hole by now this barely registers. However you try, you can't actually imprison someone for more than one lifetime, or execute them more than once.
Perhaps, sir, you could consider being completely honest with me. If I understood how you got to where you are, it could affect not my testimony per se, but at least the spin I apply.
Moore sighed and looked at the ceiling for a few moments.
Captain, you know the metaphor of the frog and the pot of boiling water?
Mm-hmm. Put the frog in cold water, heat gradually, and so on. I take it you are the frog?
Moore nodded.
And Pritchard is the water. Or maybe the fire. The metaphor has its limits.
Moore paused to scrub his face. Then he leaned back in his chair and gave Le the whole story, sparing nothing. About halfway through, Le ordered coffee for the two of them. At the end of the story, Le looked down at his cup, still half full and cold. With a sigh, he pressed the intercom and ordered replacements.
"Pritchard is definitely the fire," he said. "Although I do think you overreacted, sir."
Le waited until the orderly had delivered the coffee and left.
"While I understand what you are concerned about, I think that once the imminent threat of infection had been ruled out, a more conservative course could have been navigated.
Hindsight, Captain, always 20/20.
True, and not my place to judge in the end. For that matter, Admiral, I could be in the minority on this. I tend to be a dove on many issues.
Moore realized that having effectively given up, he felt relief more than anything else. And Lowe was being very civilized about it. He could have tossed Moore in the brig and had a good chance of being vindicated in a board of inquiry.
"We'll make arrangements," Le said to the intercom.
He glared at Moore for a moment.
"Any preferences?"
Pritchard answered right away.
"Not really. The cruisers are all of a size and have about equal weaponry. Don't try to booby-trap them. I'll know, and I'll just take different ships. But without the offloading option, in that case. Clear?"
Le made a motion to the crew chief, and he started giving orders. Le motioned with his head to the ready room, and Moore followed him in. They sat. Le did not offer Moore any refreshment, which in and of itself was a small thing, but with a large meaning.
"I spoke to the chiefs of staff, Admiral Moore. Their orders are to relieve you of authority and place you under arrest pending a board of inquiry. Unauthorized use of Navy resources, the naval exercise thing isn't going to fly, I'm afraid, and loss of two cruisers in the process."
He shook his head.
"There was some mention of interviews in process, several names mentioned. Castillo, Gerard. Anyway, you appear to be in the shit."
Le leaned back in his chair, rubbing his forehead with one hand.
I see no reason to place you in the brig, sir. However, I'll want your parole that you'll not try anything untoward, and of course I'll have to refuse or countermand any orders you give.
Moore nodded, feeling the blood draining from his head. It had hit the fan. This was the moment that every career officer dreaded. And he supposed every career politician and every business executive. The career-ending, insurmountable screw-up. Moore found himself thankful that he had no family to disappoint. The crew had been transferred out of two ships, and Pritchard returned control to the rest of the fleet. He explained that his nanites would remain ready to retake control if necessary until the fleet returned to near-Earth space. At that point, the nanites would all self-destruct. Moore stood in his customary position in the bridge. He had no illusions, though, that he was any longer in charge. His presence would be tolerated as long as he didn't create problems. He wondered idly about the outcomes of the other interviews. Castillo he could trust. Gerard, Richards, maybe not so much. They'd wavered and waffled at every bump in the road. He guessed they had folded like a house of cards at the first glare. Moore looked down and sighed. He could see a small chance of a quiet and early retirement with no fanfare or handshake. That was the best case. The next best was a dishonorable discharge and no pension. And that left the most likely scenario by far. Trial, conviction, imprisonment. For a long, long time. Unless he was proven right, then he would look like a prophet. But would it come too late?
69. Collateral Damage.
Dr. Kemp, Dr. Narang to the bridge, please.
Kemp sat up on his cot. It was nominally the beginning of sleep period. Who knew what had drawn Captain Jennings to the bridge? He dressed and stepped out of his stateroom, almost running into Dr. Narang. They proceeded together up the corridor and stepped into the lift without comment, one of the many improvements in the new vessel. No more ladder to move between levels. In minutes, they were entering through the bridge door. Lita Generis in the pilot's chair swiveled to watch them.
"What's up, Captain?"
Kemp asked. Jennings turned in his chair and gave Kemp a look that he couldn't categorize. The captain gestured to the intercom.
"Say hello, Ivan."
"Hello, Ivan."
Jennings shook his head.
"Everyone's a comedian."
He turned to face Kemp and Narang squarely.
"That is actually Ivan Pritchard on the intercom. He has apparently taken over our ship."
"What?" Kemp moved to stand by the captain.
"Ivan?"
"Hi, Doc. Glad you could make it. Dr. Narang, long time no see."
"Can you actually see us?" Narang asked.
I could if I wanted to take the trouble to take over cameras and monitoring systems, but I'm embarrassed to say I didn't even see your ship coming. I was concentrating too hard on the Navy fleet coming after me to blow me up. It can affect your concentration."
Kemp snorted.
"How's that working out?"
"Well, I took them over as well. Same process. I gathered all my nanites that I'd manufactured and tossed them toward the ships. Those that made contact simply worked their way through the hull into the ship and infected its systems. We learned a lot from the Mad Astra and the isolation module, so it was pretty quick."
"We?"
"Me and the computer. I've kind of come to accept that this is a partnership, with the computer as senior partner, unfortunately."
"Are you losing control?"
"Not yet. But the computer is becoming more opinionated, and communication is improving, by the way. The computer admits that it had to do some reconfiguration to deal with me."
"Well, that's interesting." Kemp rubbed his chin. "Do you have a more complete picture yet?"
"Hold on, Doctor," Captain Jennings interrupted. "Ivan, what about my ship?"
"Sorry, Captain. You just got caught in the by-spray of nanites. If you'd come in on a different course, you'd have been missed entirely. Of course, I'm going to withdraw my nanites. You guys are friends. In fact, done. Except for communications, because we still need to talk.
Jennings nodded, evidently satisfied, and gestured to Kemp to continue.
Yeah, so, complete picture? Kemp reiterated.
Not complete yet, Doc, but I think the problems we're running into now are terminology and culture. Kind of WTF moments.
So, Kemp prompted.
You might want to get some coffee and sit down,
Ivan replied.
I thought you couldn't see us, Narang said.
I can hear you shuffling your feet once in a while. And the doctor slurps his coffee. Sorry, Doc.
Yes, I do, and I know it.
He looked at the captain with a raised eyebrow.
Sadly, Captain Jennings replied to the unasked question, one of the few things my ship's AI cannot do is deliver coffee on demand.
Kemp nodded, and all three headed for the captain's ready room, leaving Janaris alone on the bridge. They got coffees, sat down, and Jennings hit the intercom button.
All right, Ivan, we're seated, with coffees, and we're all ears.
Right. Well, here goes. The big question for years with the Drake equation was why we don't see more civilizations in the galaxy. There was always speculation that either some of the variables were very, very heavily against life forming, or there was some other factor that hadn't been taken into account. It came to be called the Great Filter.
So there actually is a Great Filter?
Several, actually, Doc. The first is environmental destruction. Regardless of the details, increasing industrialization always has negative effects on the environment. Species that fail to deal with it always poison or heat death themselves into extinction. The second is nuclear war. Lots of species go down that way. The uploads have found a ton of planets that are radioactive wastelands. Generally, they're not usable for a long time, not even by the uploads. The third is the singularity, where the species builds an artificial intelligence that ends up supplanting them. Arts.
Uploads? Arts?
My words, of course. I'm translating everything into English concepts. Arts is short for artificials, as in AIs. The AIs that supplant biological species tend to consider that a winning strategy and will continue to do it to other species as they find them. I think they view biological life in general the way we'd view a fungal infection.
So, these would be the bad guys?
The ones that the booby traps were distributed to watch for, yes.
Right. So who created the booby trap? The uploads? Kemp took a loud slurp of his coffee and Ivan laughed.
Yes. One of the ways of surviving environmental destruction is to grow a collective brain and gear down your society to a pre-industrial level. No one picks that option, strangely. The other way to survive is by uploading your intelligence into machines and reducing reliance on a planetary environment. The uploads. They also, therefore, skip the singularity.
Uploading their intelligence into machines. The whole population? Is the process like what happened to you?
Well, generally the first attempts are a lot more primitive, scanning a brain neuron by neuron and running the result as a simulation in a computer. Often they have complex virtual reality systems created to keep them entertained and sane. My experience with the nanites is the end result of a million years of technological advances.
Captain Jennings stared into space for a moment.
So the makers, who are uploads, send out booby traps to convert hapless indigenes into uploads, who then are directed to contact the makers. My God, that would take forever.
They're immortal, Captain. They can wait 100,000 years. For that matter, they can control their clock speed or even suspend execution and sleep through long, boring periods.
And what's the ultimate plan,
once they've contacted a new race of sentience?
There are evaluation rules, Doc. This is the whole point of the computer, to evaluate the locals as candidates for, well,